Bonjour mes amis, ici Jason Solomons, welcome to the Film Weekly Cannes Special. This week we've decamped to the south of France for the biggest event in the film calendar, the Cannes Film Festival. And therefore we have a spectacular show for you this week. Later I'll be meeting director Craig McCall, who's documented the work of Cannes legend, the cinematographer Jack Cardiff. A hit at last year's festival, Eyes Wide Open, by Israeli director Chaim Tabakman, opens in the UK this week. I'll be talking to Chaim about this most unconventional of love stories. But first, there's not much robbing of the rich to benefit the poor here on the Côte d'Azur, oh non. But it is a British film, Robin Hood, that opened the festival this year. Directed by Sir Ridley Scott and starring Russell Crowe, Cate Blanchett and Mark Strong, it's a brooding portrayal of Nottingham's boys in the hood. And there's no better actor than Mark Strong for a dark, brooding and balding baddie. Strong has already delivered menace with aplomb for Ridley Scott in his role as Honey in Body of Lies alongside Crowe and Leonardo DiCaprio. This time he plays the malevolent and ambitious Sir Godfrey, who'll stop at nothing to betray king and country. I met up with Mark in London last week, but first let's hear him in action in Nottingham.
Taxation.
Taxation. Milking a dry udder gets you nothing but kicked off the milking stool.
Mother, spare me your farmyard memories. You have none, and I don't understand them.
These are difficult times. We can buy time. You can send envoys to secure loans. There are money chests from Sicily to Normandy if you know where to look.
The crown is owed money at home. The northern barons plead poverty, but that's always been the song of rich men. So what's to be done?
Give me leave, sire, to go north with a company of mounted men.
I'll have the merchants and landowners fill your coffers, or their coffins.
Mark Strong. How lovely to see you. Last time I saw you, it was in The Dorchester as well. It's like we're having an affair. Like, do you remember that film, that play, same time next year, where they used to have an affair every year in the lobby of the same hotel? You were in The Dorchester, Ridley Scott's film, last time we were here.
That's right, exactly like this, but sort of the other way round. Yeah, so it's slightly weird, yeah.
But that's obviously, yeah, that was a brilliant sort of breakthrough role for you in terms of the kind of Hollywood terms in Body of Lies with Ridley Scott. And here you are again. Obviously, it must be nice to kind of have worked your way into a director's favour so much that he calls on you again.
Yeah, I mean, that means he must be doing something right. I love the fact that, you know, Ridley's asked me to come back and do that. And, you know, Guy I've worked with a few times, and Matthew Vaughan I've worked with a few times. So it feels good, because like Russell said of Ridley, when you've worked with somebody a number of times, you don't have to do the dance with that director. You kind of know each other's footwork. You have a shorthand, and that is, you know, gets things done.
Yeah, I mean, and sort of a villainous role. Again, I think last time in Body of Lies, he was duplicitous rather than villainous, I would say. This time, Godfrey's pretty much the guy that you're going to hiss and boo.
Yeah, he's the guy you love to hate. And, you know, in every morality tale, which a lot of films are, let's face it, the good guy needs a good bad guy. I think in Body of Lies, he needed to be much more subtle, which he was. But in this, he needs to be a broad stroke, visceral, evil person that you can just love to hate.
Yeah. You don't worry about playing goodies or baddies, it seems to me. I mean, your guys often have a bit of both in them. Some people get not typecast as the villain, but kind of play enough villains to kind of always be like, I suppose it's a bit of panto anyway. This doesn't stop you coming back to be a good guy.
Yeah, it depends on me how you play each of them. I mean, I see them as individual characters. They may share a villainous DNA, but they're all different. You know, Blackwood was a Victorian guy. Harney was Jordanian. This guy's a medieval knight. Frank D'Amico in Kick-Ass is a New Yorker. So they're all, there's enough about them that's different. But, you know, a story demands that there has to be somebody who is causing trouble. And I'm very happy to play those guys because they're often multi-layered. And if the challenge really is actually to not make them two-dimensional, so you can find something in them that explains why they are the way they are, and also something that allows an audience to sort of sneakily kind of like them and hate them at the same time.
That's the trick, isn't it? Because the goodie, the people like because he's the goodie, basically. And you're generally, most of us are on the side of the angels in some kind of way. The villain, it's easy to be just bad, isn't it? But your guys aren't. They have that other side of them. Is that something that's in the script, or do you think, right, I've got to, right, he's a bit dark, this bloke, I've got to kind of bring some humanity to him?
Well, I think Helen Mirren's just quoted recently as saying, you know, why does Hollywood always cast the Brits as the bad guys? And that's an interesting question, but I think part of the reason is because we're happier with the dark side. The European sentiment is happier with the dark side. The American sentiment, I think, is much more, they want to be nice, they want to be the hero, they want to be loved, they want to succeed. So consequently, if there's a dark side, it's something that is not good and bad. It can't be celebrated in any way. Whereas I think over here we have a fascination with, you know, maverick characters like Serge Gainsbourg or somebody like that. There's some acceptance of a loucheness or a villainy that we don't judge quite so harshly.
Yeah, it occurs to me as you're saying that, you know, the Americans have a propensity to say "have a nice day." We as Brits would say "have an overcast one,"
or "take care." Yeah. Is what we say.
It's right because, of course, Robin Hood is opening Cannes. Have you had a relationship with Cannes before?
I've been over there a couple of times, but only in a very minor capacity and sort of skirting around the fringes and getting horribly intoxicated and trying to find my hotel room in the wee hours of the morning.
It'd be nice to be there, you know, red carpet first night, the big stage.
Well, that's what's so amazing, is I'm so looking forward to, you know, being in a movie that is opening the festival. You don't get many of those, I think.
No. Have you thought about this? I mean, when I was watching it, I was thinking, it's opening Cannes. Hold on, there's evil French people rounding people up, putting them in a barn, burning them. They're cowardly. They turn away. I mean, the French don't come out of this very well. It's going to foster a bit of Anglo-French kind of feeling at the opening night of Cannes.
That was my first reaction, was complete astonishment that they'd chosen it to open Cannes. But, you know, I think the panel is made up largely of French people, so if they're happy with it, hopefully the audience will be too. But, you know, it's in a massive, 1,200-seater or something, largely full of French people, and I've no idea whether what there is in this film is anti-French enough for people to be genuinely offended by.
Maybe it's your French accent they'll have a go at.
Yeah, which isn't great, I have to say.
But did you learn French for this movie, or do you speak some anyway?
No, I do speak French, and it's all right. It was good. I had to make sure that I got it right, but I concentrated on the accent, so I think it's not bad, but I wanted to make sure that it was a English-sounding French, an English-sounding French speaker.
Moi, je crois que tu as fait très, très bien, Mark Strong.
Ah, merci beaucoup. Vous êtes très gentil.
Au revoir et félicitations.
Thank you.
Now, last year's festival was without doubt a vintage one, with Michael Haneke's White Ribbon taking the top prize and Jacques Audiard's Un Prophète number 2. But many of the buzz films at the festival don't necessarily have to take those big prizes. One of last year's hot tips was a small and ambitious Israeli film called Eyes Wide Open. Chaim Tabakman's unconventional love story gets a UK release this week, fully a year after it debuted on the Croisette. Set in the ultra-Orthodox community of Jerusalem, the film tells of a destructive gay affair between Aaron, a hard-working butcher, and his new assistant, the wayward and artistic student, Ezri. Their affair both enlivens Aaron's spiritual and physical life, but threatens his standing in the community. I spoke to Tabakman from Tel Aviv to find out what made him tackle this unique and taboo romance.
וזה כבר השפיע עליך, ומי יודע איזה נבלות וטריפות אתה הכשרת כאן?
מה אתה בכלל מבין בילדים, שייגץ? תסתלק מטה!
Actually, I feel like I made something very personal. I mean, for me, it was just to express something through this society, through this inner world. It's an extreme inner world, but this is what makes it an interesting case study.
Yes.
But for me, it was really something very personal, and I didn't really knew, or maybe I deliberately tried not to think about how people will react. I just want, because it was, the big challenge was to be, I mean, deep and to make something meaningful and very honest, and I always looked inside, so I didn't really thought about how will people react to it. I honestly tell you, I really didn't know if it would be just something of you know, like a movie that will be on the shelf,
yeah,
and will disappear, or it will be, you know, very much spoken of. I really did, and I didn't really think about it. But
nevertheless, when you're making this film, you know, it's a gay love story between two religious men in ultra Orthodox community in Jerusalem. It's not a genre film. I wouldn't say, Chaim. No, I've never seen a film like this before, if you know what I mean. So you know that you're taking on ultimate taboos. You know, I mean, even the community wouldn't perhaps acknowledge that such a story could even happen.
Yeah, you know, this is the basic things that's interesting in it, because actually, you know, always my dream was to make a small budget science fiction movie, and actually I think I succeeded with this one, because, you know, as for the Orthodox community, gay people just don't exist. And I said, not that they don't think that the actual sin of sleeping with other men doesn't exist. They know about that, but they don't acknowledge the inclination for that. They don't acknowledge somebody that says to himself, I am gay, this is my nature. They might acknowledge it, but just as you know, a sinful act that a normal man just did or is doing. But he has to wake up and to understand his true nature, which is definitely not gay, because gayness doesn't exist.
Mm. It's not just about gay love. I mean, it is about lust, isn't it? And about sin. And these are age-old kind of things.
You need this dynamic between sin and lust to be a religious man, you know, because if you don't fight your urges, you get nothing to sublimate, you get nothing to overcome, and by doing that, you're purifying your soul. So if you conquered lust, if you don't have lust, then you're not really doing the work that God has designed for you.
So in a way, you view the lust that he has as a challenge, that it's actually a kind of almost like a new text to study, a new area of the Talmud to study, to overcome this lust. It represents a test of his religion.
Yeah. The hero understands that he needs the sin close to him to be religiously awakened. He has overcome. This is a guy that overcome his urges so well that he actually is almost not alive.
Yeah, it's an amazing mix that you show his family life, you show his religious life, you show his work life as well. You build these images up very slowly and very calmly during your film, very skillfully, I must say, for your first time feature. And it was a big success at the Cannes Film Festival last year. What did that success mean for your film and your relationship with Cannes? Because I know that they had your short films in Cannes as well. They kind of adopted you.
I love Cannes, I mean, it's a great festival, but it also is a great opportunity for any film because you got so much exposure there. And so many people from around the world are coming to see it, and then they can invite you to all kinds of festivals. And, you know, it's a great stage, it's a great podium to be on when you're first showing your work.
Yeah, I mean, there's been an explosion as well, because not only your film in Cannes last year, then of course Lebanon, which won in Venice as well, which also comes out in the UK this week, the same week, and also stars one of your actors, Zohar Strauss. He's in the tank in Lebanon as well. There's a kind of a big high point for Israeli film at the moment. Chaim, why do you think this is?
I think basically it's a mixture of the right. I mean, there's a basic good budget for films from the government. Also, you know, politically, Israel is very, very interesting place, and there's a lot of diversity and conflict, and I think that these reasons matured in the at the right time, at the same time, and. Although I wouldn't call it exactly a wave, because I think in Israel there's more of, you know, individuals that are growing. There's not a real strong glue between the filmmakers.
Yes.
So this is why, I believe that the Israeli cinema can have can prolong, you know, because it has so much. Diversity.
It's like Israel itself is made up of so many different people and types.
And we have enough conflict for years.
I think you've got enough material. You're good.
Yeah.
Chaim, lovely to talk to you. Kol beseder, and see you soon.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye. From the green shoots of one industry to the green shots of another. Brilliant Technicolor was the hallmark of a cinematographer who holds a very special place in the heart of the British film industry and here at Cannes. Jack Cardiff can honestly claim to be a legend, working with all the greats from Powell and Pressburger to Hitchcock and Marilyn Monroe. In honour of his status, filmmaker Craig McCall has doggedly and skillfully put together original interviews and archive to craft a handsome homage to Jack Cardiff, which screens down here in Cannes. I met up with Craig to find out more about making this documentary, but first, let's hear from the late Jack himself.
When sound films first came out, they had to be obviously synchronised, and to do that we had clappers, which was just two pieces of wood that did that, and then you'd put the sound against the picture as it closed. And the first clappers, they thought it was such an important function that they gave it to the director. But after a while, he thought it was a bit of a bore doing that, so they put the job with the young clapper boy, as he was called. He was a number boy, and he became a clapper boy. And I used to do that. Four, take one.
Craig McCall is the director of Cameraman, the life and work of Jack Cardiff, and it seems to me that Cannes is a very apt place to be talking to you about this this film, Craig, because, well, quite a lot of it takes place with you and Jack Cardiff wandering around the Croisette. How comes it that you chose Cannes to come find him? It seems to be an apt place for one of the great cameramen of all time.
Well, I think it's very apt. When I began filming this, it was 1998, and Jack was invited here as a guest of honour. And we came down to film him and start the documentary, and also a bit of a fishing trip to see, at that time, Martin Scorsese was the president of the jury. Jack had links here because when he took his foray into directing, his most successful film, Sons and Lovers, was selected for Cannes. In the 60s.
Yeah, that was an extraordinary kind of new boost to a career that was already blossoming as one of the world's great cameramen. And last year we were here with the restoration of The Red Shoes, which Martin Scorsese presented and had overseen, and Thelma Schoonmaker had kind of was here representing that. And of course, that was the film, I suppose, that made cemented Jack Cardiff's reputation as a kind of wizard of colour.
A lot of people are not sure really what Technicolour was, you know, the colour process of that time, the mysticism, but it looks stunning. And so there just seems to be a constant reawareness of it. And I think the other thing that's amazing, that I grew up in what, late 70s and 80s watching films, but often off of very bad prints that were recorded on TV. And to actually go into the cinema does transport you back to the time via the work of Jack Cardiff, Palin Pressburger, and all the other people that worked on those amazing films.
Scorsese is a very kind of key element of your film. He gives you a wonderful interview. He's clearly energised by Jack Cardiff's work, sort of basically kind of almost says that, you know, because of Jack Cardiff, he has an interest in cinema himself. It was that kind of transporting to another world that Jack Cardiff's photography and the Palin Pressburger works do that kind of made Scorsese the director he is today.
He, as he says in the film, he continually takes recourse into the three Paul Pressburger films that Jack photographed, The Matter of Life and Death, Black Narcissus, and The Red Shoes, but he has a particular obsession with The Red Shoes. In fact, in the documentary, I split the screen between Raging Bull and The Red Shoes, and you'd have to watch it to see why, but a lot of people come out and just really love that bit. In fact, one of the reasons this film began was I got in an argument in a pub in Soho in London, and someone was saying, Craig, you're so full of shit. What do you mean there's a sequence in Raging Bull that's based on a ballet film in England? I said, well, there is. And it took me several years to actually put Mr. Scorsese in a documentary and prove my point. I can't even remember who I had the argument with, but if you're out there, come and watch the film.
It's true. Well, Scorsese refutes it, absolutely, and it's a brilliant moment. The film is a treasure trove of insight and film anecdote and film technique. I mean, we're talking about the stars that Jack worked with, Marilyn Monroe, Ava Gardner, Ingrid Bergman, and then, you know, the greats like Errol Flynn as well. I mean, there's a wonderful bit where you start the film and you ask him, when did you begin in cinema, Jack Cardiff? And he has a think and he says, 1918. And he's almost shocked himself that basically the history of cinema is kind of writ through this man like a giant redwood tree.
Jason, it's exactly that. I mean, one of the people ask why Jack. Jack was his peer group. It was an amazing array of British cinematographers who had influence all over the world. But Jack was also a raconteur. He's very affable, very modest. But the length of his career, because he actually began in 1918 at age 4 as a child actor and pretty much carried on filming for 90 years. He actually worked in the business for 90 years. There's very few people who can say that. And basically, Jack, it is a film about a cameraman, but it is also the story of cinema, literally the first 100 years of cinema.
The thing was that in your film he comes across as a total gentleman, as a kind of guy who must know thousands of secrets. You know, there's a wonderful bit with Marilyn Monroe and he sort of says, oh yes, darling girl, had a few problems. And that's it, you know. I mean, he must have known the secrets of everything. I mean, lighting these women, making them look beautiful. Very discreet though, always, but gives you just enough to make this documentary absolutely fascinating.
I think one of the things I tease at without being explicit in the film was Jack became very consummate as a great person to light films, but he was also an ambassador. He also was a diplomat between the directors, the actors. I think one of the reasons, the hidden reasons that someone's successful in the film business, but talking about it in Cannes, is there's the unspoken stuff. So he was the lieutenant to John Huston. He was the lieutenant to Alfred Hitchcock. And that's both dealing with technical issues, which are easy to kind of encapsulate in writing books and things like that. But in my film, what I've tried to do is present to you, without explicitly saying, what did he also bring to the team? What did he also do? What did he say to Marlon Monroe to nudge her around, to get her maybe onto the set a bit quicker, to make the whole thing done? And so Jack, when you look at him, you see that twinkle in his eye. I think quite a large part of that was what the man brought, you know, is what he brought to the whole potion of filmmaking.
One last thing that I suppose this can in particular has kind of relevance as well, is because there's a reprint, a restruck print of The African Queen playing in Cannes Classics, which of course forms quite a good part of your movie as well. The story of making that film in I think it was Ghana somewhere, they went, there was some godforsaken place that
Belgian
they didn't want
Congo.
To, the Belgian Congo, marvellous. And I think the place had a wonderful name, I can't remember.
Biondo.
The place was called Biondo, and Jack has a kind of pretty gentlemanly way of saying yes, and it really was Biondo. You know, the relevance of his work is still going on. Every year Cannes seems to be sort of reviving more of his work, different types of work. Red Shoes and African Queen couldn't be two more different kind of colour palettes, but still fantastic work on both.
The section's called Cannes Classics, and to their absolute credit, Cannes have this section to show restored works, to highlight filmmakers that haven't been known, hopefully with new prints, and also documentaries on filmmakers. So Cameraman, the Life and Work of Jack Cardiff, is one of four documentaries in this year. And yeah, I would have to say that I can't think of a more perfect place or people who appreciate Jack more than to be here at the Cannes Film Festival this year.
Well, I'm glad you could join us, Craig, here at the UK Pavilion. I think the helicopters from Apocalypse Now are coming in to join us. The sights and sounds of Cannes, and no greater than your film here, Craig McCall. Thank you very much for joining us on Film Weekly.
Thank you very much. I'm glad to be here.
Craig McCall's fine documentary, Cameraman, The Life and Work of Jack Cardiff, is on release in the UK as well, and there's a BFI season celebrating the films of Jack Cardiff all this month at BFI Southbank. Go to bfi.org.uk for information. It's often said that the Cannes Film Festival is the Critics' World Cup. We get all the films from around the world, and we critics have to test whether these are works of genius or outright works of a charlatan. Well, to do that with me is Zan Brooks. Zan, we're back in Cannes. Welcome again.
Here we are again.
I know, it comes round every year, but this
it's
is
like
it. It's
Brigadoon, isn't it?
It's true.
We get a little older, but it stays the same.
It is an exciting time because all these films are laid out before us like a great panoply. We don't know anything about them before we get here. Were you looking forward to them as a selection?
Well, I think what needs to be said is that last year's selection looks more vintage with each passing moment. Last year was the great auteur smackdown, as Variety coined it. We had films from sort of Haneke and Tarantino and Lars von Trier and Pedro Almodovar, and they were all here. It was all the heavyweights. This, on the face of it, looks like all the middleweights. There's a lot of names here that I'm utterly unfamiliar with. Maybe that's no bad thing, because it is a festival of discovery, but it doesn't give you much to work on straight away.
I would wish the competition itself could do with a bit more heft, it seems to me, but as I say, we're only starting to delve our little toes into it. But we did start with a big bang. We had Robin des Bois, or Robin Hood, as it's known. It had a big start. It had Sir Ridley Scott. We had, of course, Russell Crowe. We've had Mark Strong, of course, just now. What did we make of the film? Because it's open in England as well. The world premiere was here in Cannes, but it was actually opened in Leicester Square about sort of 4 hours earlier. So people back at home can see this film. What are they in for?
Well, what they're in for is, I think, a very professional piece of carpentry by Ridley Scott. I think it's a medieval summer blockbuster that knows exactly what it's doing and does it very well within those confines. It didn't particularly move me in any way, but I found it perfectly diverting and entertaining.
It's being billed as an origins story.
Yeah, like Spider-Man.
Yeah, and I mean, I didn't know this until sort of the film was almost finished, and I was like, oh, that's what you're doing. I was thinking, where are the Merry Men?
Because, yeah, where's the sheriff? The sheriff's kind of barely in it.
Yeah, Matthew McFadyen, and then, and you know, really really, I didn't know what was going on. I thought they were going to go off in the woods and be outlaws, but no, they're coming back from the Crusades, and they're trying to work out, you know, how what sort of state England's in. I thought this was a bit of a mess, and you could feel, I don't know if this is because I knew there was a troubled production behind it, but you could feel that it wasn't quite decided what the story was going
to
be.
It's certainly not the film that they initially set out to make. They meant to make an entirely revisionist Robin Hood, almost with Robin Hood as the kind of Osama bin Laden figure, kind of hiding out and utterly evil, and the sheriff is the good guy who is out to track him down, which is a neat
idea.
That
sounds good.
It's a neat spin. They chickened out. They don't do that. This is very much Robin as the hero and the man of the people. Russell Crowe, I think, does a good job. I think he's an effortlessly confident actor. It's a part that maybe calls for sort of great bombast and thunder, and he just underplays it, and it works well.
I wanted a bit more lightness, a touch, a bit of wit. I mean, maybe the ghost of Errol Flynn that's living over here, or even the Disney character who was the little fox.
Oh, the foxy,
but, yeah. Yeah, he was lovely. But I missed, there was no jokes in it, and I thought it was all a bit silly, really. And when you're not doing that, Mark Addy as the Friar Tuck making his mead with his bees. I just thought it was so serious and po-faced that it was very easy to make fun of it.
Ridley Scott doesn't really do jokes, though, does he?
He takes
himself quite seriously, and this is a big, thunderous epic.
Well, you know, Cate Blanchett and Russell
Crowe. I don't
like
Cate Blanchett.
In general, one likes her?
I don't actually.
Oh, right, really? What's she
really
done to you?
Don't. Well, there's a long story there. Actually, there's not. I've barely met her. But I find her a bit mannered. There's classy support out on the sidelines here. I mean, obviously, Mark Strong, I think, is always good value. Max von Sydow is great. Although, there's a moment in there where he's totally blind all the way through it. And then there's a point where Robin and Marion are dancing at a great distance in the dark. And he looks over and gives them a little smile. And you think, but he's blind.
Yeah, but
What's he looking at?
He's Max von Sydow. He knows everything. Is it going to do well as a blockbuster? It's a kind of the most adult blockbuster around. You know, it isn't a superhero. It hasn't got kind of a postmodern kind of take on things. Are people still going to flock to this?
I think they probably will. It's certainly, in terms of its casting, it's not really going for the youth vote, is it? I mean, you know, everyone here is sort of pushing 40 at the very least. Maybe that will have an effect on the sort of multiplex crowd, but I think it'll do all right.
What about as a can opener? I mean, traditionally that's not a great film, but recently they've kind of got Hollywood
Up last year, which was wonderful,
and that set everyone off in a very good mood. Everyone floating on air, they were having looked at those balloons.
Well,
I think this one's kind of given everyone a bit of a sort of a muddy forest kind of feel.
It did, and it significantly it sort of played out to barely any applause at all, which is, I think, rare for the can opening film. Also, there's a sense that the organisers maybe dropped the ball a bit in having a film as their opener that has already screened elsewhere in sort of preview screenings and things like that and is now out. It's maybe not the great unveiling that you need for a festival.
Yeah, that was my feeling as well. But we'll leave Robin Hood there, and you can go and see that all around England this weekend. We'll see some films now that you probably will never see in the light of day again. These are a couple of the rarities that were kind of forming the competition. One of the great French actors, who many people will know as the villain in the Quantum of Solace, Lucien Green, wasn't he? Mathieu Amalric, he's directing a film and starring in it. It's called On Tour or Tournée, and he plays a sort of down on his luck producer who's come back to France with a troupe of burlesque dancers, and he's trying to find them a theatre in which to play. Was this just an excuse for a horny Mathieu Amalric to hang out with lots of strippers?
It may well have been, but I disagree that we're not going to see this film ever again. I think that this will get a release. I think Amalric is probably one of the very few French actors who actually has a profile outside of France, mainly because of the Bond role. He was also in The Diving Bell and The Butterfly. He has a sort of recognition value. And maybe this is a bit of a vanity piece. It's a bit meandering, it's aimless, but it's also very nicely observed and well played. I thought all the burlesque dancers act very well. I'm sure they're probably acting themselves.
Yeah.
But all those little details rang true, and the details of sort of life on the road and the sort of the unglamorous bits of France, the sort of chain motels and filling stations and sort of flea-bitten little seaside resorts.
Yeah, Nantes and
Le Havre. That was kind of nice.
Yeah, these are the women are Mimi Lemot, Dirty Martini, Rocky Roulette, and Kitten on the Keys.
Yeah.
To give them their
dues.
And
there's some great set pieces. pieces. I mean, you know, this is surely the only film that we're going to see at this year's Cannes where somebody pulls a load of streamers out of her arse while the band plays God Bless the USA. We're not going to see another one like that.
Really? That's a shame. There's not enough of that around. I thought it was indulgent, as you say. So it was Fellini-esque in a way, kind of had a sort of satirican kind of feel to it, or Amarcord in a way, and also a bit of La Strada because of the itinerant nature of it. I felt it was too indulgent for my liking. And there was no drama in it. I was like, what's going to happen? Oh, nothing. Good.
Nothing really. I mean, it's a sort of redemption play, really, isn't it? But it's a redemption play that doesn't really build. And when it ended, I thought, oh, right, OK, so that's it. It's over.
So you think we're going to see this in the UK at some stage?
I think we are, yeah.
All right, then. I'll bet you we're not.
All right, let's have a bet on it.
Okay.
50 euros.
50 whole euros, which by the time it comes out in the UK, they make me totally totally devalued. It'll be about threepence. We're going to move on to a Chinese film, which I do look forward to seeing in Cannes every year. There is a sort of always a fine piece of work from China that sometimes it contravenes the censors in China.
Yeah.
A couple of years ago, Liu Ye's film.
And often is never seen again. Like Liu Ye's Summer Palace a couple of years ago, which was a great film saw here. And then just, I think it cropped up once at the BFI South Bank, but that was it.
And even his film from last year as well, about the gay lovers that were shot in China as well.
Swing Fever.
Which was, I thought, a beautiful one that won the screenplay prize here. The Chinese offering from this year is by the guy who gave us Shanghai Dreams a couple of years ago in Beijing, Bicycle, Wang Xiuxia. I hope I pronounced that correctly, but even if I didn't,
no one's going to
know that. It's Chongqing Blues, which kind of goes with what he does. He looks at cities and kind of sets a little tales there. It's a tale of a man who's been at sea and comes back to try and find out the reason why his son has been shot in a supermarket siege. I thought this was from the first shot, which was of a cable car against a blue sky, and then a kind of misty, kind of skyscrapery, kind of burgeoning Chinese city. I thought, brilliant. I love this sort of movie.
Yeah, it's a great sense of modern day China, isn't it? Sort of crammed and teeming with this cable car, rickety cable car, just stuffed full of people, and then getting out and then darting down these little alleyways
and people playing mahjong,
skyscrapers everywhere. It's an incredibly atmospheric film, and I guess what it is, it's a sort of emotional detective story, isn't it? It's the dad, you know, looking back to try and find out what happened to his son and where it all went wrong. And this is a son that he hasn't seen since the son was 6 years old. And it's sort of moving in a very kind of quiet, naturalistic, understated way.
I thought for an hour it was going to be brilliant, that I would be able to kind of gush about this and say how fantastic it was. It sort of lost a bit of its momentum for me.
It did a little bit. But it's still an outside contender, I think. I did like this a lot.
Yeah, me too. That's Chongqing Blues. Look out for that one. I think we may see this Chinese offering in the UK. Should we go to Italy?
Let's go to Italy.
One day you can travel the world here without a passport. That is Cannes for you. We'll go to Italy for a TV presenter who's new to me, now is making her first movie, Sabina Guzzanti, with a film called Dracula, which is a pun on Dracula and Aquila, the town which of course had that tragic earthquake in the Abruzzo region of Italy. This is subtitled Italy Trembles, and it's an examination of Silvio Berlusconi's handling of that disaster. I thought this was kind of urgent political satire, quite good.
It's urgent political satire, and it's also whipped up a bit of a storm here on the Croisette with the Italian culture minister refusing at the last minute to come to Cannes because he says that this film is a film of lies and misrepresents the Italian people, in that it basically it accuses Berlusconi of rampant crookery.
Really?
Shock.
How dare
it's
they?
It's always the ones you least suspect.
Every year we come to Cannes, and there seems to be. I don't really know much about Berlusconi through the British press, but every year you come to Cannes, there's an anti-Berlusconi movie. There's about four of them. We had The Caiman from Nanni Moretti, we had The Il Divo, which sort of reflected on that Italian politics last year. Mm. I mean, they seem to have a slight agenda here at Cannes that I think they perhaps want to. They don't think Berlusconi very highly. They don't think very highly of Berlusconi.
Well, maybe the Italian minister is right then to feel kind of victimised here. But the interesting thing is that one of the accusations that is made in this film is that Berlusconi draws up these emergency measures that he then misuses. So everything's an emergency, and that means you can't actually, all your civil liberties are curtailed and you can't actually protest. And if you do protest, you risk like a 5-year jail sentence. But isn't the Italian minister protesting this film? So I worry that when he goes home, they're going to throw him in the slammer.
They might do. Tell us how she does it, because she's been sort of hailed as sort of a Michael Moore of Italy.
Yeah, it's very much Michael Moore. It's very kind of jokey. There's little cartoon segments. There's a moment where she dresses up rather annoyingly, I think, as Berlusconi and does a little speech in Aquila. But it's still a very entertaining, pointed, passionate film.
Did you feel there was much journalism here? Did you think that she was just kind of going, well, Berlusconi is terrible, we don't like him? Did you think she actually had some facts to support
that?
Yeah,
she did. Yeah. I think it's polemic, and she was, you know, obviously went in with an agenda. But, you know, the implication is that the Italian media is so cowed and so much in his pocket that none of this actually gets reported. So you do need films like this, flawed though it might be.
Yeah, no, I was fascinated by it, and kind of it kept me sort of on edge as to the facts and figures, and was this possible at all? But it did kind of show how absolute power corrupts absolutely with people as its victims. So I was quite impressed by Dracula. Zan, we're going to have to sort of bring the films that we've seen so far to a close. But what are we looking forward to if we just set a scene for those at home?
Well, what have we got coming up? We've got Wall Street, Money Never Sleeps, by
That's
Oliver
true.
Stone.
It never does.
Never does, particularly when we've got a bet on. We've got Chatroom, which I'm interested in seeing, the Hideo Nakata film.
With a young British cast.
Ender Walsh playing.
Yeah.
We've got Mike Lee with Another Year, which is another terrible title, I think. Another Year sounds really dull, but apparently it's a very, very good film from him.
I think it could be it's a contender. He's back in Cannes in competition, I think, as a contender. Anything sort of coming up next week that we can be looking forward to, that we know about? I mean, there's the Doug Liman's here with Fair Game,
Naomi Watts as CIA agent Valerie Plame.
Who also pops up in Lucy Walker's Countdown to Zero about the nuclear weapons, the real Valerie Plame pops
yes,
up, and then she's
yes,
played
she does,
by,
yeah.
by Naomi Watts. So I never heard of Valerie Plame before this.
Had you not? This is one of the big stories over in the States.
Yeah, but
what
you know what?
What were you doing?
Yeah, I don't know. There's always these films about these people in Cannes, you know, like Daniel Pearlman, the kidnapped journalist.
Yeah,
I was
yeah.
thinking, oh, I should know about these stories. And I never do. And that's why I need the movies.
You find out the world through the movies.
Yeah, exactly. That's how I live.
Another thing that I would like to see is Outside the Law by Rashid Bouchareb, which is basically a follow-on from his Indigenes of a couple of years ago, looking at the fallout from the Algerian War of Independence. And again, this is another film that's kicked up a big stink, this time in France, in that it's being seen as anti-French.
Yes, I mean, Days of Glory, Indigène, that kind of prompted a law change. It kind of gave veterans of the African veterans some actual money that the President Mitterrand, I think, kind of in his last outgoing gesture, kind of gave them the pension. It also stars Jamel Debbouze, Roche Dizem, Samy Boujenah, kind of big French thing that's going to be right at the end of the festival. That's my little tip sort of Palme d'Or.
Okay,
glory.
That sounds kind of good. One film that I suspect I won't get to see is Carlos by Olivier Assayas. I like Assayas. I think he's good. This film is 5.5 hours long, and I think that however much I like Assayas, that's a big ask.
Yeah, in France, that's unspooling on, I think, 4 separate nights on telly. So they're showing it here as a movie. It's going to be like watching the entire Wire episodes, and
see,
that's
I'd
what
do
they're doing.
That. I would do
you
that.
You would do that?
Yeah.
Yeah.
But is it going to be as good as The Wire?
Probably not.
No.
But it will have subtitles, so you'll be all right. Zan, lovely to see you. You can, of course, read all of Zan's musings on Cannes daily and weekly on guardian.co.uk/film. But now it's lunchtime in Cannes. The rosé is being uncorked and the goat's cheese salads are out, so we're going to have to end our first Cannes special there. You can always find out more this Sunday's Observer, my trailer trash column, and my first Cannes roundup. The best news and reviews from the festival, of course, on guardian.co.uk as well. But until next week, from me, Jason Solomons, and my producer, mon grand producteur, on Film Weekly, Jason Phipps, it's au revoir et à bientôt.